Good morning. You've tuned into 88.5 KRFY. This is North Idaho News of the Week. You are listening to myself, Jack Peterson, and Mark Warren here from KRFY, as well as Zach Hagedon, the editor-in-chief of the Sandpoint Reader, kindly joining us this morning on the airwaves. Good morning, Zach. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
What we're going to do is run down the news of the week, as the show title says. So I'm going to jump right into it. We have some stories today. For one, we want to start with a wildfire update because a series of wildfires scorched North Idaho over the 4th of July weekend. This from CREM 2 News. Above average temperatures and little precipitation caused wildfire activity to spike over the 4th of July weekend in the Idaho Panhandle. A string of wildfires over 4th of July weekend. According to the USDA Forest Service, it was above average temperatures and little precipitation that led to wildfires in Ponderay County, Clark Fork, and Coeur d'Alene. Fire officials say the fire in Priest Lake, known as the Consolis Fire, sprouted on Friday, June 30th. Officials say it's estimated at 50 acres and burning in heavy, dead and down timber. The fire is precisely located above Consolis Creek near the Pelkey Divide in Ponderay County, Washington. At this time, a 10-person district module, a 20-person crew from Grangeville, a dozer, and an excavator are working to suppress the blaze. Two additional 20-person crews are expected to join the effort. Here in Sandpoint, the fire known as the B-Top Fire was reported on July the 1st, currently estimated at 25 acres. It is located near B-Top Mountain, and district resources and smoke jumpers are working to put out the fire. Additional resources are on the way, including a Type 3 incident management team from the Northern Rockies. In Coeur d'Alene, three wildfires were reported. The Hill Creek Fire near Bumblebee Peak was contained at 0.4 acres by firefighters, while the Buckskin Fire was controlled at 0.2. The Big Elk Fire is still burning at 0.82 acres, but is expected to be out by now. This report is a couple days old now. A 20-person crew is currently working to put it out. That's the fires that I know about. We have an update, I think, on the B-Top Fire, which is the one closest to us.
Yeah, this is out of the Bonner County Daily Bee. The lightning-caused fire reported Saturday has burned 32 acres and is about 5 miles northeast of Clark Fork. And there are 61 fire crews assigned to this fire.
Okay. So that's not necessarily a positive development because it was 25 acres earlier, so it's growing. It's not shrinking.
This does say that Northern Rockies incident management team has taken command of the fire, so it is seemingly getting better.
Okay. That's your wildfire update from us. It doesn't seem like the smoke has gotten to us that severely yet from any of these fires. It's been a little bit hazy, but not as bad as you might think with all these fires around us. Item number two on our agenda is the open primaries challenge. What's been going on with that? If you listened to the morning show here on 88.5 on Wednesday, you heard an interview with Luke Mayville from Reclaim Idaho, who is one of the groups supporting a ballot measure to basically restructure the way that elections, primary elections, and the general election are run here in North Idaho, or not just in North Idaho, in the whole state of Idaho, I should say. This from Clark Corbin of the Idaho Capital Sun. Supporters of a proposed open primary ballot initiative announced July 3rd that they are challenging the ballot titles assigned June 30th by the Office of Attorney General Raul Labrador. The challenge represents the latest development in a dispute between supporters of the initiative and the Idaho Attorney General's office. A coalition of groups called Idahoans for Open Primaries is backing the initiative, which would do away with the closed primary elections and replace them with an open primary that all candidates and voters could participate in, regardless of party affiliation. I'm going to try and sum this up here, basically, that the The Republican primary in particular is a closed primary, and there's a feeling that that is the most important election in the state. And so the supporters of this bill are trying to open that up to all voters in the state to be able to participate in. The Attorney General's office turned around and accepted the initiative, but gave it split it into two and gave it two different titles. Do you have those titles in front of you, Zach?
I do. Yeah. So on Friday, Labrador issued those ballot titles for the initiative, and the short titles from his office. And this is according to Idaho Reports, so Idaho Public Television. Would read, Measure 2, 1, replace voter selection of party nominees with non-party blanket primary, and 2, require ranked choice voting for general elections. So he's clearly trying to make this into two separate initiatives, which he has argued consistently violates Idaho constitutional code, saying that citizen initiatives must deal with one subject only. And so his interpretation of this initiative as being two separate issues related to, you know, the voter selection of party nominees with non-party blanket primaries, mm-hmm. and also require ranked choice voting in general elections, he's separating the primary from the general and saying that that's mm-hmm. in violation, and he will sue
yeah.
if it gets onto the ballot. And, of course, the folks behind the initiative are arguing that this is one issue, and that issue is elections.
Yeah,
and that they will sue if he sues, and so now we have kind of a legal standoff between the Attorney General and the Open Primaries Initiative folks.
Yeah, and as I said, you can hear an interview. I think they spoke for about 35 minutes about this whole subject on Wednesday here on 88.5 KRFY, and if you missed it, you can go to our website, KRFY.org, and listen to that, as well as, I'm sure, following coverage of the developments in the Sandpoint Reader as things move along. Item 3 on our agenda, the 2022 crime report is out. Mark, what do you have about the 2022 crime mm-hmm. report is out. Here it is, 2023. What did we learn about crime in North Idaho in 2022?
Yeah, so it's got the breakdowns between different police departments in Northern Idaho, as well as the Bonner County Sheriff's, and the total of Bonner County, so I'm going to go through some of those. Mm-hmm. From the Sandpoint Police Department, there are 423 total offenses, which is down 8.84% from 2021.
Hmm.
238 of those were cleared offenses. There were 395 arrests, down 4.13% from 2021, which has been a, the trend going downward has been something we've been seeing for the past 4 or so years. Out of the Bonner County Sheriff, there was 996 offenses, 3.02% down from 2021, 715 arrests, which is down 3.64%. This one, they've been going down since 2020, so for the past 3 years, where in 2020 they saw a spike from 2019. And then the total of Bonner County, there was 1,582 offenses, which is down 6.22%. And then there was 1,389 arrests, down 5.7%. Another one of those things where we've just been seeing a trend downward for the past few years.
Yeah. You know, what's particularly interesting about that to me is that in 2021, we were still at least somewhat in lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it seemed like there was just less activity around in general. So for 2022 to then have a lower crime report is...
Well, what I think is interesting is 2019 across the board was lower than 2020. So 2020 saw a spike from the previous years.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting statistics, I would say.
Did they give much analysis for for why those numbers would be declining? Because those are big percentages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They did not. They just have the numbers on there.
I would speculate maybe that there's something to do with demographics in this area. Mm-hmm. We have a much older than average population here. And I, just seems to me like just anecdotally, retired people don't commit as many crimes as as younger people. Maybe
that's true. Yeah, or at least the cops don't get called if they do. We have, I forgot to put this on our rundown, but the Idaho Capital Sun on July 5th had a headline, Idaho awards $1.2 billion contract for behavioral health. Both of the losing bidders for that contract sued the state. Idaho state agencies are facing two lawsuits after a new expanded $1.2 billion contract to manage behavioral health services statewide. Contract, which could change care as soon as next March, controls how more than 425,000 Idahoans, which is about one in five residents of the state, access behavioral health care. The new organization selected, Magellan Health, will manage care for Idahoans on private health insurance or Medicaid and those who are uninsured. The new contract includes inpatient care, like hospitalization for mental health issues, while the previous contract only included outpatient care, like visits to a therapist. A managed care organization is a company that manages healthcare benefits and care for patients. One Idaho analyst sees the new contract structure as promising because it makes one company accountable for the costs of a patient's entire mental health care. But two companies who lost their bids for the contract argue that the process was flawed, alleging that the state made errors in evaluating proposals. So the state is now facing two lawsuits from Beacon Health and Optum Health, who lost the $1.2 billion contract for behavioral health. Do we, unless there's comment on that, I'm going to move on to our all-important local issue of lifeguards at City Beach. From the Daily Bee of July 6th, there will be no lifeguards on duty at City Beach this summer, most likely anyway. They only received five applicants for the job, and City Administrator Jennifer Stapleton told the City Council on Wednesday that the city does not have staffing to operate its lifeguard program. The city has not canceled the program, as was suggested a few years ago, Stapleton told the Daily Bee. Quote, we are experiencing the same employee shortage most of the employers in our area are facing. Recruitment of lifeguards has been a challenge across the country, and we've seen reduced pool hours in our community and regionally as a result of a shortage of lifeguards, end quote. Stapleton told the council that city staff have had extensive and ongoing conversations about possible options, from just staffing one lifeguard stand to limiting the number of days that lifeguards are on duty. The positions, which will remain posted, have been shared in the media and on social media. In addition, local swim teams, the YMCA, and others have been approached for assistance. Quote, but at the end of the day, staffing challenges have just been such a challenge, end quote, says Stapleton. I've seen the posters around town looking for lifeguards and things right. like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was surprised on the weekend of the 4th of July to see those towers empty when I went down to the beach. But there you go. There was conversation among the council mentioning that maybe it's time to further raise the wages of the lifeguards to see if they can recruit some more lifeguards, but that probably won't take any kind of effect until next summer by the time all's said and done. So right. Looks like no lifeguards at City Beach this year.
Well, one of the things that wasn't mentioned in that B story, mm-hmm. We did a piece on this back in May. Our publisher, Ben Olson, mm-hmm. did a story about the shortage. And one of the critical things that, you know, he heard from the YMCA, which is, you know, sort of the place where these kids get trained,
yeah,
is that during the pandemic, we had basically 2 years where no one was training to be lifeguards,
yeah,
because no one was going anywhere. They didn't want to get a bunch of people in a pool together during a pandemic.
Yeah.
So you have a 2 year gap in training and you disrupt the pipeline for, you know, kids cycling in and out sure. of the seasons.
And returning lifeguards from the previous year. And
so that's a big part of it too. I mean, there is sort of a narrative out there that like people don't want to work or they're not getting paid enough. But the other reality is that they simply weren't trained
yeah.
for 2 years, mm-hmm. and you have to start over from scratch, unless you're going to get older people who've already gone through the training and are going to come mm-hmm. back. But that's hard to do in a lot of cases because the kids who are doing this are often, you know, college kids, you know, home for the summer, mm-hmm. or, you know, they might be especially good swimmers in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just trying to find that sort of scheduling to, mm-hmm. to make that work. I think that's a big part of this issue too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a swimmer in high school. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time for me to put on the trunks again.
I think that would be great, Jack, if you were down there up on the stand.
I think so. Like, yeah, like David Hasselhoff in Baywatch. He must have been in his 40s by the time that show was.
He's on. Ageless.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on to some county issues. We have a zoning change denied at Dufert and Vey. Now, there was no county commissioners meeting this week because of the holiday, but this from Lindsay Kiber-Carey from the Sandpoint Reader. The zone change for a gas station at Dufert and Vey Roads was denied. Bonner County Commissioners ultimately struck down a comprehensive plan map amendment and zone change in June that would have paved the way for a gas station and other amenities at the intersection of Dufert and Vey Roads. After 8 hours of comment and deliberation over two public hearings, not to mention the planning and zoning hearings that took place preceding the BOCC hearings, commissioners ultimately ruled that the proposal was not in alignment with the county's comprehensive plan and zoning code. What the proposal was proposed by Sean and Laura Hammond and applied for a zone change from Rural 5 to Rural Service Center on about 12 acres just south of the Willow Bay Resort last year. The board at the time, which included Commissioners Dan McDonald and Jeff Connolly, no longer on the board, voted unanimously December 21st to remand the file back to the planning department and encourage the Hammonds to apply for the comp plan map amendment, which the Hammonds did ultimately file, requesting a change on their property from rural residential to neighborhood commercial. What they had intended to build was a gas station, a convenience store, boat storage, and 5 1-acre residential lots. Ultimately, the current board, denied the comp plan amendment request on June 14th. And then the hearing was continued after 4 hours to June 26th, during which the board denied the zoning change. There was a lot of comment apparently during the June 26th, as you don't expect from an 8-hour meeting. And ultimately it was Ahmed and Williams who pointed out that the Hammonds knew what the property was zoned for when it was purchased. Williams said the file requested what she believed to be spot zoning, the act of changing the zonings of a particular property despite it not being in line with existing standards for the area. Bradshaw then ultimately aligned his vote with the other two commissioners, and the board unanimously denied the zone change. This is a particularly interesting development because that's a little unusual for them to deny a zoning change, at least in this day and age.
Yeah, I mean, zone changes and comp plan amendments have been kind of flying through the county on various levels. So this was kind of an unusual occurrence. And, you know, not only that, but just the fact that all three commissioners agreed on something.
Yeah, that's true.
They don't tend to get along, you know, so much on a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
So to see all three of them vote in favor or vote to deny, that request was kind of unique. And I think it's also indicative of sort of the unease that a lot of folks have in more rural parts of the county where they're seeing a lot more intensification of use. They're seeing, larger parcels of land being broken up into smaller pieces. They're seeing more density showing up in the countryside. And then, you know, with a commercial use, that is quite a bit different, you know, than what a lot of these neighbors were used to seeing, and potentially why, you know, some of them might have moved out into that area. They didn't want to be near a commercial center.
Yeah.
And there is already sort of some intensive use along that part of the county, you know, with the resort and the activity on the river. So I think that's probably why the commissioners voted the way they did, is that they heard from people in the surrounding area that they just didn't like the intensification of the use.
Yeah.
And it may not have been specifically, you know, like they don't want a convenience store. They just didn't want anything.
Right.
So I think that there's a lot of that going on. And you hear it in other parts of the county too.
Yeah.
Any kind of greater density, any further intensive use is going to spur a lot of pushback.
Yeah.
And we've seen that a lot in the northern part of the county. And now we're seeing it in, you know, sort of that river portion.
Do you know, does the Willow Bay Resort complex, do they have a gas station in that area at all?
I don't know.
Meaning, so you'd either be going to Sagal or to Priest River from that kind of central area.
I think Priest River and Sagal were probably the places to go. And I think that's a large part of why the property owners wanted to do what they wanted to do.
Right.
And they make the case, you know, during the hearing, you know, it's like, this is something that everybody needs. Like, this is a benefit to everybody who lives around here. It's not a detriment. I mean, it's going to save you time going to get gas. It's going to save you time going to the convenience store for, you know, whatever sort of small items you might need. It would be a convenience. I mean, it's a convenience store. So I think they were a little bewildered maybe by why there was so much pushback. But I think it's just part of the broader trend in the county overall, where people are starting to get a little wary of seeing big changes to these rural parts of the county. And, you know, like Williams and Ahmet said, you know, it's like you knew what it was zoned when you bought it.
Yep.
So,
We get now to our big story, the ongoing issues going on out of the West Bonner County School District. And I'm glad that Zach Hagedon is here, because you have the first two pages of news in the Sanpoy Reader are devoted to one issue or one article written by yourself. How many words is this, Zach?
I think it clocked in at around 2,600-ish.
My goodness. Well, in all of it, fascinating. You start with kind of a rundown of the issues in general, and then the article ends with the really interesting problems that the Reader itself has been facing, as well as other education news outlets around the state, to get information out of the West Bonner County School District, which you can update us on today. If you don't mind, I'll just read from your article. I'll read your words back to you here. Weeks of controversy have roiled the West Bonner County School District as its trustees have hosted a number of charged public meetings related to the hiring of Brandon Durst as superintendent. Trustees approved Durst's contract on a 3-2 vote on June 28th, as well as declared a state of emergency, which was required for Durst to secure an emergency provisional certification from the Idaho State Board of Education in order to do that job. Brandon Durst, is a high-profile political figure in Boise who once served as a Democratic legislature before switching to the Republican Party, under which he unsuccessfully ran for state superintendent. He has close ties with the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which has its own lobby arm, the Idaho Freedom Action, which is a large and influential Idaho lawmaking or organization holding influence over Idaho lawmakers through its various media channels and Freedom Index, ranking legislators based on how closely they hew to the organization's free market libertarian ideology. Skipping ahead here, the board's acceptance of Durst as superintendent over Susie Lucky sparked outrage in the greater Priest River community. Lucky has served as interim superintendent since March 2022, following a near 40-year career in the district as an educator and later principal. She received an emergency provisional certification to work as superintendent on June 14th, which was the same day that the board voted to no longer consider her for the top job in the district. That is the update on, I guess, the superintendent issue, but immediately then we skip to the trustees, who are now facing a recall effort with an election set for August. Chair Keith Rutledge and Vice Chair Susan Brown are subject to a recall effort. The enough petitions were signed and submitted to the county clerk that they will be holding an election on August 30th, I think?
August 29th.
29th. That they'll be Tuesday, August 29th, yeah. That they will be subject to recall, and then they would no longer be on the board if that were the case. I think I'll leave it there for now, just to ask. Would you say the Durst decision is final? Is he officially now going to be the superintendent, or do we wait until after the election to find out if that is going to hold?
It appears that his contract has begun.
Yeah.
According to the Idaho Education News, they approved the contract in addition to a salary of $110,000, running from July 1st this year to June 30th next year. So, yeah, I mean, Brandon Durst is the superintendent of West Bonner County School District.
Yeah.
But if this recall election plays out the way that the people who, you know, are behind it want to see it play out, then Keith Rutledge and Susan Brown will no longer be on that board, and then a new board could be put in place, and, you know, conceivably they could terminate his contract.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point of the recall, right, is that that people are angry, you know, at least enough people are angry in the district to get this thing successfully sort of pushed through, that there's been a voting block on the board.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very consistent, 3-2.
Mm-hmm.
And that 3-2 vote is what got Durst considered. Mm-hmm. It's what got Durst hired. It's also been behind a number of other decisions that some people quoted in the petition for the recall that they were unhappy with. Specifically the returning of an English language arts curriculum after it had been approved.
Yeah.
You know, these board members took political exception to some of the content in the curriculum, so they sent it back, and that cost the district a bunch of money.
Yeah.
So, it's a culmination of things, but it really the reason that, you know, the folks who signed these petitions want to see Rutledge and Brown out is because of the way they've handled this hiring of the superintendent.
Yeah.
And I think the intention is to get new board members so that they can terminate the contract with a supermajority.
Yeah.
Because they already have two votes on there who consistently have taken exception with how this has gone. So if you get two more people on there, then you're going to have, you know, 4-1 potentially.
Yeah.
It just depends on, you know, who gets in there, but I think that's probably the end goal for a lot of the people who support this recall.
Mm-hmm. The contract itself, does that line up more or less with contracts for superintendents in rural areas, as far as you know, or is it some of the figures were kind of eye popping to me.
It's including pretty well accepted around the state that this was an unusual contract to begin with, especially. So the first version of the contract that went before the board had all kinds of stuff in it that made a lot of people scratch their heads. One of them was, you know, providing legal coverage for Brandon Durst's wife.
Yeah.
There was a stipulation in there that he could work remotely during non-school hours, that he would be able to eat free lunches at every school in the district. He was going to get a car that was no older than 10 years.
Yep.
Mileage reimbursement, housing stipulation, relocation package, you know.
Yeah.
And then a large salary. And I think that the large salary probably isn't too out of line with what a lot of superintendents make.
Yeah.
But it's because it's a hard job. It's a job that requires advanced degrees and a lot of experience.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what people have taken exception with. I mean, the ultimate contract that was approved didn't have a lot of the weirder items in it. It did include 12 days of illness, injury, and emergency leave, 20 days of paid vacation, a mileage reimbursement, $2,000 for relocation. And then Brandon Durst is able to undertake consultative speaking engagements, writing, lecturing, or other professional duties and obligations that do not conflict with his duties as superintendent.
Hmm. the proposed one would have required a supermajority to terminate his contract.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make it into the final contract? Do you know?
That one I need to look at again. Okay. Again.
Yeah.
I'm not too sure about that particular line item because they really haven't shared this contract. See, that's part of the problem.
So
Idaho Ed News.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the meeting as well. And I saw what Idaho Ed News reported was that they put the contract up on a screen in the meeting room.
Yeah.
And it was only up there for a little bit.
Yeah.
Like just a kind of a brief moment. One of the people who was in attendance at the meeting managed to get a photo of it with their phone.
Yeah.
And then they posted it on Facebook.
Huh.
So that's the only, you know, public sort of like widespread access to the details of this thing.
Yeah. I think that's been something that a lot of local people, a lot of parents have been upset with is the lack of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that the media has also dealt with. In the article, you talked about issues with public records requests, and that's something that Idaho Ed News has seen. Can you talk a little bit about like what your experience has been with that?
Right. Yeah. To kind of back it up just a little bit, the process by which the county school district has gone through with this whole thing has been an issue with transparency generally. And the folks who are behind this recall petition, that's one of the things that, you know, that they're unhappy with, is that there's not a lot of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw that in clear evidence at the last meeting when there was an attempt made at the beginning to approve the contract in an executive session, which is against Idaho code.
Mm-hmm.
You aren't allowed to do that kind of thing. And, you know, Chairman Keith Rutledge was reminded of that by Trustee Margaret Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And so they eventually had to open that to the public, which is the one time we saw the contract had flashed up onto the screen, mm-hmm. you know.
Hmm.
So they didn't want to even do it in public in the meeting.
Yeah.
And that's indicative, I guess, of a larger stance that I've experienced. And what you were referring to regarding public records is that at an earlier meeting in June, I want to say it was June 14th. So on June 14th, there was a meeting held of the trustees, and it was only lasted about 8 minutes.
Huh.
And it was gaveled out a session. They tabled everything that they were going to talk about. And what they were going to talk about was potentially rescinding Durst's contract and the addendum that had a lot of the more unusual items.
Mm-hmm.
And in that meeting, Keith Rutledge said, you know, their evidence had recently come to light, quote unquote, of, quote, improper and unprofessional discussions that may have occurred between district employees and legal counsel with regard to this subject, that such discussion may have violated proper procedures following the executive session of June 7th, and which requires further investigation. So that pricked up our ears mm-hmm. when we heard that.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that about, well, what, 5 days earlier? Yeah, 5 days earlier on June 9th,
mm-hmm.
The Sandpoint Reader had filed a public records request with the West Bonner School District.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to know was what kind of discussions were occurring between district trustees, with district staff, and with Brandon Durst.
Mm-hmm.
If there were discussions that were occurring between the district and its employees and the Idaho Freedom Foundation, you mm-hmm. know, because of Brandon Durst's association with the IFF.
Yeah.
If they had been communicating with the Bonner County Republican Central Committee, mm-hmm. which has been very vocal in supporting Brandon Durst, with Senator Scott Herndon, who has been vocal in his support for Brandon Durst,
mm-hmm.
and any other sort of references to the Central Committee, to the BCRCC, et cetera. We ended up breaking that into two public records requests, one focused on Brandon Durst and the Idaho Freedom Foundation and their correspondences, and the other sort of between the district and the local Republican establishment.
Mm-hmm.
We had, you know, communications with the district, with the records clerk, the custodian. You know, we heard back within the statutorily allowed 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
We were told that it would be a 10-day extension, which is legally allowed. And so we were to expect those records on the 23rd of June.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the interim, you know, we learned also that there's a board policy, board instituted policy at the district where records requests have to go through legal counsel. And that's not entirely unusual. But, you know, whatever. And that was the reason we were given for why there was going to be a 10-day extension, was that legal had to have a look at it.
Yeah.
Never mind the fact, you know, it needs to be remembered that public records are public.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they are not owned by the institution that has them. They are owned by the public. The, mm-hmm. the institution is merely a custodian of those records, and they are to be available upon request
mm-hmm.
Within a reasonable time frame. And they were allowed to give us that 10 days extension. And so we heard back on the 23rd that yes, our records would be processed. However, they would carry a $312 fee,
mm-hmm.
For 1.6 hours of work.
Yeah.
And we objected to that in writing, citing Idaho public records law, which is clear on numerous occasions throughout the code section that work of fewer than 2 hours is not to be charged.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we cited that.
Yeah.
Along with a number of other instances where you can't charge, like say if the person who's requesting doesn't have that amount of money,
right?
Mm-hmm. They can't charge you. And frankly, we don't have $312 to spend on a public records request.
Yeah.
So there were all kinds of different reasons why we were entitled to these records for free.
Yeah.
We were told, well, it's, you know, it's an attorney issue. So we requested an itemized list of expenses, which is also afforded to us under public records law. They aren't allowed to give a lump sum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They have to tell you exactly why and exactly what is being charged.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we got an itemized list, and it was one item. Uh-huh. It was $195 an hour for legal counsel.
Yeah.
So we adamantly refused to pay that and adamantly wanted our records.
Right.
Because at that point, you know, we were past the legally allowed time to deliver the records.
Yeah.
So we got in touch with the Idaho Press Club, which is our statewide sort of membership organization for media of all different types.
Mm-hmm.
And we pay a yearly subscription or whatever membership due to be a part of this group. And they have successfully sued in the past for public records.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what they're there for, is to be an advocate mm-hmm. for state media. So we got in touch with them, told them the situation, gave them all the documents, showed them our records requests, showed them the emails that we'd received, the itemized, list of expenses. Then they came back and said, yeah, this is bogus. They sued Ada County, the biggest county in the state,
mm-hmm.
in 2019 because of mishandling of public records. And it was a slightly different situation, but it was a lot of shenanigans where Ada County was giving them the runaround on timeframes, on, I don't know if it was a cost issue necessarily, but it was definitely a time issue and et cetera. They sued, they won,
mm-hmm.
and then Ada County had to dramatically change the way that it does its public records custodian work.
Mm-hmm.
So the press club president, Melissa Dablin, wrote a letter and sent it off to West Bonner County, sort of underscoring that we had a right to these records, that, precedent had been set in this Ada County case, and, we look forward to seeing the records. We didn't hear anything back. A couple days go by, and, eventually we sort of kind of lost our patience a little bit, especially after we saw this Idaho Ed News post from their mm-hmm. editor-in-chief, Jennifer mm-hmm. Swindell, that detailed a number of other instances where they'd been trying to get a hold of public records from, University of Idaho and West Bonner, and they had been getting a similar kind of stonewall, I think was the word that Swindell used. So I reached out to her and let her know that we were having something similar, and we'd been actually dealing with this longer than they had.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we agreed that, we would sort of keep an eye on it and potentially do something if we needed to, like jointly, either via a complaint or some kind of other legal action. And then after that, and then another phone call between the publisher and West Bonner that was not entirely collegial, we did receive our records yesterday.
You did get them. Okay. And this was not yet in the, this does not appear in your article. So,
No, as of press time on Thursday, we hadn't received them.
Yeah.
But we got them on Thursday after the article came out. I don't know if that was coincidence or not, but
yeah.
But almost a full month after we had originally requested them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I scanned through them. I got 177 pages of material, and I am currently processing it. But what I can say is that it does not appear to bear much relevance to the substances of my two requests.
Hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out exactly why that is.
Yeah.
So there are elements in the request that do line up with what I was actually asking for, but the vast majority of it is not apparently related to what I was wanting to know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there will be more on that. And in the meantime, I guess we're just keeping an eye on whether or not Idaho Ed News gets their information.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see the text of their requests, so I don't know what exactly they were looking for. Although they did mention that they were looking for correspondence between mm-hmm. the board and Durst.
Yep.
And I do find it a little bit hard to believe that not a single email was sent between the, this guy who wants to be the superintendent and anybody with a district email address.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I would have thought mm-hmm. that I would receive that.
You would certainly think, if you're sending a job offer, that they would probably get that by email.
I mean, I suppose it's conceivable that every conversation occurred over the phone or in person.
But
I would be kind of curious to know how that worked.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty unusual. Go ahead, Mark. Were you going to say something there?
No, I didn't have anything.
Oh, okay. Well, we've gone over time, which I think is a problem that we are going to end up facing with this show as time goes on. I guess we'll just look forward to future reporting on what you find out from those records, Zach, in the Sandpoint Reader.
Here's hoping.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in today and joining us here on North Idaho News of the Week. Zach Hagedon, again, is the editor-in-chief of the Sandpoint Reader, as well as a reporter on, what do you consider your areas of expertise, Zach? What's your areas of focus? Education, apparently.
I actually don't tend to write about education all that often, but this is, I think, more politics than anything.
Yeah.
I definitely have been a political writer for a long time, so that's probably where my strengths lie.
And people can find you online at sandpointreader.com?
Yep.
Is that right?
Sandpointreader.com.
Okay. Mark Warren, thank you as well for being here. And we're going to, I think, wrap it up and leave it there.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. And that's the news of the week from 88.5 KRFY. Stay tuned for Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long here on your community radio station. This is Panhandle Community Radio.